Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Slavery in America started with the sale of 20 humans in Virginia 400 years ago. The Transatlantic Slave Trade Database puts the number total over that period at 12.5 million Africans who were shipped to the New World before slavery was abolished in 1865. And the lasting impact of slavery continues to shape our nation today, touching nearly every aspect of our society, from social identity and culture to housing and healthcare and just about everything. Javon Collins is the performing arts director for the King Arts Complex, which has programs coming up on this topic. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries is a professor of African American history at Ohio State. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
You know, we're talking about this. We were kind of spurred to action because of the four-part series in the New York Times coming out about it. I know Washington Post is coming out with something. Probably lots of newspapers are coming out with something about this. 400 is kind of a nice, clean number. But is it too little, too late, Hassan Kwame Jeffries?
I don't think it's ever too late. But more could always be done. This is an opportune time, I think, to ask the nation to pause and reflect and to begin and continue conversations that often haven't been had in the public. And it's generated a range of responses that hopefully we can get into, from surprise and overwhelming feelings of sadness and sorrow, to outright anger, both from people not being exposed to this history and from people accusing those who are trying to shine a light on this history as distorting history. So it clearly, I think, has the New York Times 1619 Project and these other ones focusing attention on what the King Arts Center is doing clearly is timely, but is a part of more that I think is needed.
It's also a lot for a lot of people, and it kind of reminds me of the feeling that people have, say, during Black History Month, where all of a sudden you're inundated and it's a lot and it's important, but why isn't it a constant topic of conversation, Javon?
Yeah, I think it's uncomfortable for a lot of people. And, you know, from people of African-American descent, it's, you know, really a sense of PTSD. Some people in the African-American communities, they don't want to discuss slavery. And you think about, you know, the generations that were coming about in the 1800s and early 1900s, a lot of the elders didn't want to talk about it. But, you know, what was important that came from that were the slave narratives, when they actually spoke about the experience. And that firsthand information can definitely help others. And, you know, what we have now today with human trafficking. But that experience, you know, left a lot of pain and anguish and a lot of confusion. So therefore, it's an uncomfortable situation. But without uncomfortability, you can't grow. So we got to face these topics, everyone, to discuss them so we can move forward to the future.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. 400 years ago, slavery began in the United States. It was, of course, abolished in 1865. But the after effects have lingered to this very day. We're interested in your thoughts this hour. So if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. Hassan, what about the New York Times? You said surprise, sadness, anger, but a lot of people are saying that it's unbiased, it's unfair. Once again, it's picking on the whites, that kind of a thing.
Well, I don't think we can separate history from politics, and so much of the criticism of those who are talking about and shining a spotlight on 1619 and the 400 years, 250 years of slavery, 150 years of formal racial discrimination afterward, are upset at the image and version of the past that does not comport well with how they want to portray the past. This myth of perpetual racial progress, that, yeah, things may have been bad in the past, but slavery existed, but there was a civil war, and not only did that end slavery, that ended racism. The battlefield leveled the playing field, and that simply isn't true. So not only have we done a poor job of dealing with the legacy of slavery, being principally being white supremacy, and how that justified racial discrimination for another 100 years formally and informally for 50 afterward. But we haven't done a good job of even dealing with what slavery was beyond being an economic institution, but the ways in which it attempted to dehumanize people and just actually what took place for those 250 years after 1619.
What was happening here? What was the difference between what was happening in the New World, in the colonies, when slavery was instituted in 1619 that wasn't happening in the countries that were colonizing the United States?
Well, this was, I mean, it's about sort of colonial agriculture and the production of sort of cash crops in these particular places. We often think associate slavery in the United States with cotton, but it was tobacco, and it was a tobacco boom that saved the colony of Virginia. And the need for cheap labor, free labor, enslaved labor that could cultivate and harvest this golden cash crop that puts and saves the Jamestown colony and eventually the American colonies in what will become the United States. You know, they're not growing tobacco in England, and it's those tobacco in the Americas, and it's sugar. So it's these agricultural crops, addictive agricultural crops, that really are fueling the transatlantic slave trade and the demand for labor. In addition to mining, early on, it's the Spanish first dealing with mining and enslaving native people, expanding that to bring in Africans. Sugar becomes this major plantation crop in the Caribbean. And the colonies, the American colonies, you know, we often have this sort of nationalistic impression of America first. The American colonies were an afterthought. They were so small. But it's really slavery that begins to allow the American colonies to thrive and to flourish and eventually giving rise to the United States.
And then the powers that be back home in England or you know, Paris or London or wherever it might be, they just went along with it because it was out of sight, out of mind?
No, they went along with it because it was profitable.
It was profitable for them.
I mean, they're making handle, and this is eventually what will fuel the Industrial Revolution, right? I mean, the raw materials that are coming out of the Americas and the colonies, whether it's gold coming out of the Spanish colonies being mined by enslaved labor, whether it's sugar down in the Caribbean, or it becomes tobacco and eventually later on cotton in the United States, which would fuel internally the rise of the American nation, the American state. So it's not so much a blind eye. They knew what was going on. It was this thing is making us money hand over fist, not only for individuals, but then also for the nations themselves, the crown, if you will.
Right. The taxes, the revenues from it. Is there been, you know, you said we need to talk about what slavery was, that we don't even have a good idea about what it was. So what do we mean by that?
Just understanding what it really meant and just how devastating it was to, you know, a culture of people for hundreds of years. Again, just like Dr. Jeffrey said, I mean, it was about the economic, you know, upliftment of those countries for the colonialists. And I think it wasn't really a thought of the human conditions. It wasn't a sense of humanity, the two-thirds of a man, just treating human life as if it was not worth, you know, sugar or, you know, other commodities coming in. So just the fact of people living but really not having a life.
I wrote for the billboard at the top of the hour that many were taken so young they didn't know the names of their homeland, let alone their very own name. They didn't know how old they were. They didn't know what day they were born on. And that the taking of humans for enslavement has left a hole in the fabric of the United States. But that conversely, the people who were taken also filled this nation with every manner of consequence, medicine to politics to culture, you know, you name it. It's an interesting phenomenal dichotomy when we think about it.
It
how
is.
How rich we are for it, and yet how poor we are for it.
And that's part of, I think, the difficulty in explaining this and talking about this and teaching this. Slavery was an economic system that was designed to dehumanize. That's the only way it could operate and work as efficiently as it attempted to be. But at the same time, it failed to rob the enslaved of their humanity.
Yeah.
Now, we actually perpetuate the dehumanization of people who were enslaved by just referring to them as slaves, as opposed to, for example, enslaved. And slavery was a condition. And so just as you point out, I mean, it stole. I mean, this is kidnapping, right? I mean, it robs, it takes people, kidnaps them, separating, divorcing them from their culture, from their community, from their place of birth and origin, their history and their heritage. And yet at the same time, people who were enslaved were able to reconstruct, were able to cling, were able to hold on to, were able to pass down the core elements of their own African humanity. And so both have to be discussed at the same time. And it's not to discuss one, to discuss the humanity, what African people were able to endure, does not lessen the horror that was American slavery, that was the transatlantic slave trade. So it's not about letting that off the hook. At the same time, it's okay to focus on the horror, but then also say, look, this is what it actually was. And we have to be clear about that. But it failed to dehumanize in the way that it set out to do.
And therefore enriched us in a way that is hard to talk about too sometimes. We're going to continue our conversation. We are talking about a particular date and the significance of it, 1619. It was August 1619 when the first Africans were brought to the United States. 20 of them were sold at a market in Virginia and kicked off 250 years of legal enslavement of human beings in the United States and in other places in the Americas as well. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. My friends in the studio today, Javon Collins, he is performing arts director for the King Arts Complex, which has events planned to commemorate this time. And also Hassan Kwame Jeffries is a professor of African American history at Ohio State University. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you want to join the conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the history and the legacy of the enslavement of humans in the United States. My guests are Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's professor of African-American history at Ohio State. And also Javon Collins is performing arts director for the King Arts Complex. The third annual African-American Cultural Festival is this weekend, Friday and Saturday, at the Mamie Moore Park. Yes. You can visit a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information about all of that. Terminology matters when it comes to the history of slavery in the United States, started in 1619. And there's been a lot of debate over the idea of arrived versus landed versus immigrated. That has been the immigration thing has been a kind of an amazing description of what happened. Why does it matter, Hassan?
I think it matters because people came to the shores of the Americas, the colonies, the United States, in different ways. And it's important that we distinguish between those who arrived voluntarily and those who were brought, who were forced to be here, because that begins the arrival point, the way that we arrive, begins the telling of the story and the arc of the story. And if you just position people as sort of voluntarily arriving, what you're actually doing is erasing the circumstances and conditions upon which they encountered at their moment of arrival. Which, I mean, if you're arriving voluntarily, you have a different set of obstacles than if you are brought here literally in chains. Mm-hmm. And sold from ship to shore. And so I think that we have a terminology problem, but it literally begins at conception. At that moment. So we have to be careful about how we distinguish between those who are voluntarily coming and those who are brought here involuntarily, literally in chains.
You know, a big part of what's missing sometimes in the whole conversation, or at least when we envision what happened back then, is how they were taken in the first place. What happened in Africa, on the continent of Africa, and in the countries there that we don't hear a lot about. And I'm wondering, Javon Collins, how does that manifest? Is there much art or is there much cultural significance to that?
Absolutely. You think about the ancestors, who were, coming from Africa. They made sure they brought items from their motherland to take with them. But the artistic, element of it was always there. I mean, you think of, the drum, you think of the conversations, you think of the quilts during the Underground Railroad. That was a level of communication that was unsaid, but set up by a group of people who was forbidden to read and write. So there was a certain level of excellence and community. They had that within them, even though it was, so many attempts to strip that from them. But their goal was to make the best of that situation. You think of the food situations for the enslaved, taking collard greens, turnip greens, the ingenuity, just so inventive in making that situation because it was survival of the fittest.
If you think about it, if people went through that today, a lot of people might think about the depression that might overcome people, the mental illness that they may sink into. Is there any record of that, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, about, those kinds of issues that...
Absolutely.
Did anyone keep track?
Well, it depends on who the record keepers were. And often during the Middle Passage, for example, there would be onboard ship physicians. And if you look at their records, they talk about a particular malaise or a melancholy. You have to read between the lines into that. But I think one of the sort of points of evidence is looking at the actions of those who were brought in chains. High rates of suicide.
Yeah.
That is a reflection of not only depression, but also resistance, right? But if you can imagine, we think about and talk about, and your question was really great, the slavery sort of, or enslaved folk arriving on ships, we might deal with the Middle Passage, but the ships sort of appear on the horizon, right? But that's not where the story begins. I mean, these are a people, as Javon pointed out, with a culture and community. They're not kidnapped as empty vessels. They're not transported as empty vessels. They don't arrive as empty vessels. The wonder is that anyone survived this.
Yeah.
With some sense of their own humanity, given how traumatic it absolutely was, being torn from. I mean, the equivalent today would be somebody dropping into your home, taking you out, and then taking you to another planet,
yes,
right, where you have no idea, yes, of what's happening, and but the only thing that you know is you're never going back. You see no way back, and you see no way free. How does that absolutely impact your mind and your well-being? It's amazing to me that anybody survived that, let alone the numbers that they did with their minds intact.
By the time the enslaved Africans were talking, by the time they were being interviewed, maybe they were former slaves. By that time that they came around and they were talking about what they went through, this was many generations later. Is there very much evidence about what they were going through from their point of view back in, the 17th century? Yeah.
Well, what I mentioned was the slave narratives. Most of the enslaved that actually were still alive after the end of slavery, I believe in the 1930s and 40s, they were able to catch up with them and speak to them and give their full, documentation of their experience. But the early, enslaved, there's not that much firsthand documentation. But at the same time, the things that they left, the things that were going on, in a sense, were an example of what that experience was like. And some of those things that we discussed before, it's just amazing, as you said, for the ancestors, those who survived, and to just keep a level head, to continue to push forward. And I think that DNA is within, you know, the African descendants today. But I do believe as much as the communities, we do have a common ground, and we have to find that, especially amongst the African Americans and the Africans who are in America now, just to get that common understanding, because there's a disconnect with some in understanding that experience and why the conditions for African Americans are still at a certain point in 2019.
There is the third annual African American Cultural Festival Friday and Saturday at the Mamie Moore Park. You can check out a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information. We're talking about 400 years since the enslavement of humans was introduced on American soil in Virginia. 20 people were sold. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. My guests are Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's a professor of African-American history at Ohio State. Also, Javon Collins, performing arts director for the King Arts Complex. Javon, can we talk a little bit about how performance helps us maybe translate some of these issues, or helps us see some of these issues for what they are when so much solid documentation is lacking?
Yeah. A lot of people are visual, especially now, 2019. It's about a photo. Some people would rather see a photo than actually read about something. So for those who are visual people, a performance definitely reaches a different level of their understanding. To physically see it rather than to read it and imagine it, I think is a different way it touches on the human heartstrings. And that's why it's very important to, for those who don't have an understanding, to seek out other ways to get the information. And with performing arts, visual arts, it allows the viewer to kind of get an idea of that humanity and what that person may have been going through to create that response via their art. So we are working on a project with an amazing choreographer, Jamal Brown of Onyx Productions. The piece is entitled 20 and Odd, and that's what the title was given for the first ancestors to make it to the shores of Point Comfort, which is very much Hampton, Virginia. But those enslaved were traded for food. And, you know, just the impact when I was, you know, doing my research, it made me cry, because just, you know, that was the level of their life. That was their worth.
The value.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Tony in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Tony.
Hi. I was wondering, does Javon Collins and I don't know if his name is Alshon Jeffrey or
Hassan.
I'm sorry. Do they even like being called black people? Because when I refer to, when I call into the show, I don't say, hey, can I speak with the white people? I that whole perception, the depth of it kind of draws me backwards, and I'm trying to move forward with them. So do they even like the whole label of black people anymore? I mean, it seems so outdated.
Well, everything's changed, but Hassan Kwame Jeffries, what about how we refer to each other over time, and how that's changed, and what does that reflect about us?
Well, certainly the ways in which African American people of African descent have referred to themselves has changed over time. Labels are a reflection of society, and all labels have an inherent political weight to them. Coming out of the civil rights era, people of African descent in America rejected the label Negro or colored. So as long as you're not calling me Negro or colored, I think we are all right. And there was an embrace of black, all right, as blackness, as a positive, as opposed to the usual negative. So I think in the contemporary moment, most people of African descent are totally fine with being called black. It's in the census. Are totally fine with being called African-American, totally fine with being called African, people of African descent, mm-hmm. That connection back to the continent, into the diaspora. But the thing with black, I think, is you have to just be careful not to objectify, right? And so when the president of the United States gets up there and talks about, I like the blacks, or that's my black, right? I mean, that's showing some type of ownership and possession, and that is totally inappropriate. But black people, I think, you know, for most folk would be acceptable. Certainly African-American. I consider myself an African-American, but a person of African descent in America. That's a mouthful. But I think it speaks to people's own self-identity and awareness and connection to the continent.
Mark in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Yes. Good morning, Dr. Jeffries and your other guest.
Javon Collins, right?
John Collins. My question is, and I'll be brief, what is the best way to propose this subject into a school curriculum?
Well, it already is in school curriculums now, one way or another. We were talking off air earlier, though, that for many years it was just there was a war and slavery ended, and that was kind of it. That's pretty much what you learned growing up in grammar school in the United States. It's changed, but it's still. What do you think, Hassan Kwame Jeffries? Depends on the student.
Well, I think it depends on the school district, and I think it depends on the school itself. I've had the pleasure of working with the Southern Poverty Law Center's Teaching Tolerance Project, and we have an ongoing project the last 2.5 years called Teaching Hard History American Slavery, in which we've developed not so much a curriculum, but resources and frameworks for understanding and teaching the difficult aspects of American slavery accurately and effectively. And I think that can be, you can go to Teaching Tolerance's website, draw those materials, and I would absolutely encourage teachers and parents to encourage their school districts to take a look at that material because it offers ways to teach this history from literally K all the way up through 12.
Without making it a Black History Month kind of a outside the realm of that sort of approach.
No, absolutely. Okay. And I think Brother Collins would agree that this is a 365-day a year history. This is American history. Now, Black History Month is absolutely important. It allows for a special highlighting, an emphasis, a focus. But if we only look at, in this instance, American slavery during Black History Month, if we only look at American slavery in the context of what it did to Black folk, then we really are not understanding what American slavery was and its influence and impact on the nation as a whole.
Right.
You can't understand American development. You can't understand the Constitution, the Supreme Court, the Civil War, the American Revolution, the founding of this nation without a fundamental understanding of the centrality of American slavery.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. You know, this putting in the shadows the history of African-Americanism is not just about the enslavement of humans. It's not just about the Civil War or the Jim Crow era or any of that stuff. I mean, when you – well, I suppose at Jim Crow, this was partly it. But I just – when I watched Hidden Figures, the movie about the women who – without whom the space program would have been altered, you know, at the outset, I was angry. I thought, how in the world could we not know – about these critical characters in the history of our nation. So there are so many stories to tell.
It's fascinating. I mean, for me, you know, just from my education at The Ohio State University and just going on to my travels at the King Arts Complex, every day there's another story. There's something else one can learn. And I think, you know, the fact that, you know, our ancestors, the people we're standing on the shoulders of, they endured so much that a lot of, you know, people now could not even fathom going through that. But yet to rise up to the occasion and be so selfless to know that, hey, I'm treated like a second class citizen, but yet I know I'm a first class citizen. I know that I'm brilliant and I have these skill sets. And they're just hoping for that opportunity. So with Hidden Figures and so many of the other stories, it just shows the excellence of African-Americans and people of the African descent. Because if you go in the old books, they rated, you know, the Negroid the most unintelligent human. And that was just bias, first and foremost, but also not the facts. And I think that, you know, since that narrative has been going on for over 400 years, it's hard for those to know that, hey, I am of this when they're looked at as if they were not, even with their amazing efforts, with all the Black inventors, the stoplight, you know, kind of everything.
It's
kind of
crazy.
But since they weren't, you know, given or deemed, you know, American citizens, they weren't given the proper respect that they should have received for the things that they did.
You know, I just said something. I said it's kind of crazy. And it does feel like it's a form of insanity sometimes how our country managed in the first place and how it coped in the second place mm-hmm. with it all. It seems sort of insane.
Well,
I don't mean to sound glib either. I mean, it feels crazy.
It is crazy when you think about what it took, the sort of mental gymnastics that one had to do in order to treat another people the way that they have been treated, and then to justify it not only in the moment, but then for another 150 years after. In other words, to live with this type of oppression. Right. And that's the power of racism / white supremacy, because it provides this justification that enables white Americans to go to sleep at night. The only way that you can treat another people the way they with that type of barbarity is if you push them out of the human family. And we have never fully reconciled with bringing people of color back into the human family fully and wholly.
I was listening to an interview with a Rhodesian colonist, white colonist, and how she was raised not to show pain or suffering because that would give that would be a flawed then example of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't. I mean, and I thought, and she talked about how it was nuts. I mean, but that was why they weren't supposed to show pain if they were hurt or anything, because, well, you're the white family and you can't ever show. It's affecting everybody.
It does. And that's why I say that white supremacy isn't something that ended in 1865. And white supremacy is really the principal legacy, in my opinion, of slavery, because it provides for the justification, the rationalization of the continued discrimination and maltreatment of people of African descent going forward. And it's not just limited to the impact or mistreatment of African Americans. When we're talking, you listen to the language around immigration now and the willingness for people to accept putting children in cages. When you look at the shootings that are taking place in El Paso, it's the language of white supremacy providing this rationalization for this inhumane and inhuman behavior. That's a legacy of slavery.
We're going to continue our conversation. 400 years ago in August this month is when the first enslaved people were brought to the United States. Back then it was a colony. It was called Virginia. It was the first. It was only 13 years old at the time. 20 people were sold from ship to shore. And from there, it ended up being around 12.5 million people brought by way of Middle Passage to the Americas. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll get to our calls we have waiting, and we'd love to hear from you, too. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It started with the sale of 20 humans in the colony of Virginia in the year 1619. It's according to the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database. By the time slavery was abolished here in 1865, 12.5 million Africans were shipped to the New World. That's what we're talking about today. My guests are Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's a professor of African-American history at Ohio State University. And also with us, Javon Collins. He is the performing arts director for the King Arts Complex. There is a third annual African-American Cultural Festival on Friday and Saturday at the Mamie Moore Park. You can check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information. I'd like to hear from our listeners, too, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Hassan, whoever they were, started this in 1619, was did they know how big it was going to get? How huge? Did they plan to make it millions of people?
Well, certainly, I think they had an understanding. We're talking about the Virginia colonists here.
Yeah.
They had an understanding.
The people who did it, the slave traders.
But it had been growing. I mean, so by the time you get to 1619, this is almost a fully formed system.
Okay.
America was an afterthought. I mean, it was so small, the Americas, the English colonies.
That's what you said, yeah.
You know, Barbados, Brazil, I mean, it had already become a thriving system of bringing enslaved laborers, enslaving, kidnapping, enslaving, and transporting them across the Atlantic. So I would fully imagine that if they assumed that the colony would survive, and that was the purpose, and grow, that they knew that it would need to do so using the labor of enslaved Africans for the purposes that they were setting out to do.
In other words, there wasn't a plan to we're gonna start this way because we have to, because that's the only way you can make a profit. But eventually, that was never.
Well, no, there's a decided turn to it, right? I mean,
Yeah. They're
realizing like, okay, this is
they'd tried and that failed, and that's when
and tobacco again is the key,
right?
Because they're going the Jamestown colonists are going there thinking they're going to find gold, right? That doesn't turn out. What saves the colony is tobacco. And then as the demand for the tobacco begins to expand and grow, then there's this need for labor. And they're tapping into this cheap labor that is being provided through the transatlantic slave trade. But that's the beginning. And then, of course, reasons and motivations change. So by the time you get to 1670, 1680, 1676, Bacon's Rebellion, there is this decided switch in saying, wait a minute, you know, we need to create this permanent underclass of people of color to deal with some of the class tensions that we're having. And then at that point, by the time you get to early 1700s, this is a permanent phenomenon in the American colonies.
Job in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Job.
Hi, Ann. How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you.
Thank you very much for giving me a chance to speak on this very important topic today.
Sure.
I was listening to your guest on the
Job, I want to interrupt you, Job. You just got very muffled, so you got to make sure you hold a phone right to your mouth. Okay, go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I was saying that the people you have on the studio are very knowledgeable about this topic. I'm from Africa. I just moved to America. I've been here for the last 20 years. And the topic of slavery is a very thorny issue to most of the people in Africa and African American. And when we look at it, we see that slavery in itself, the kidnapping and enslavement of the African people in America was not what they wanted to do. No human beings ever wanted to do what was done to these people.
Mm-hmm.
They were brought here by force. They were enslaved, mistreated, and millions of them died in the sea, in the Atlantic Ocean.
Right.
When we look back, we blame those people who were the slave masters and say they were barbaric. They did evil. They did wrong. And that is true. But the question now I have today, 400 years later, what have we learned? And what has America, the United States of America, done to undo the injustice which was afflicted to the African people?
Right. Well, Job, let's hear Hassan Kwame Jeffries. First of all, can you undo?
You can't undo the past. The past is the past. But you can deal with the legacy of it and address the legacy and influence and implications. This speaks, I think, directly to the question of reparations. And when we think about when we think about slavery, certainly the reparations question is situated in an American context. But slavery was a global system. And we do need to address. I mean, the reason why Africa is the way Africa is not only has to deal with colonialism, it has to deal with slavery. And when we're talking about addressing the problems that people face today as a result of slavery, we do have to look at it globally. We do have to look at not only the nation states that participated in it, England, France, the Portuguese, the Spanish, but we also have to look at the Catholic Church.
and the institutions that enabled the slave trade and slavery to thrive. So without going into the particulars of how do we do that, it certainly needs to be on the table of who is responsible, not only for the past, but who's responsible for addressing the past in the present.
And where is that past? I mean, I guess I just suddenly had this flash of that HBO show Left Behind. And I wondered, you know, people were left behind in Africa, in the different countries. What is there any history about that, about all of a sudden people were missing? Did they know? And what were they doing?
Yeah, no, certainly. I mean,
and the theft of that, the theft of the humanity from a community and from a society.
And it's so that, I mean, it's a great question. And the answer is complicated.
Yeah,
because we're also talking about some time. We're talking about centuries. And as a result of that, certainly people are feeling the loss of individuals. But we're also talking about the destabilization of entire regions. Now, the whole continent doesn't disappear. The continent continues. People and communities continue. But we do have to take seriously the destabilizing effects of wars solely for the purpose of enslavement. And then on the heels of that, the transition from taking people out to extracting resources through colonialism, because that's part of a direct connection. And there are scholars, anthropologists, and historians who are looking at the effects of that over time, the destabilization brought about by slavery leading into colonialism.
Job, thanks a lot for your call. Shantae in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Shantae.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I just wanted to call and say that I have a history myself identifying with Black and both Native American. I come from a mixed family. And growing up in school, I always learned and was taught that our history pretty much started with slavery. And we came from Africa, didn't really much learn about what we did before. I've just always learned in school through education that slavery was the start of us in America. But looking into my genealogical records, I found that my family, even though dark-skinned, we're actually Cherokee, and we were made to change our identities through the census to Negro and colored. And I just wanted to know when we are going to start talking about who we were before slavery and how we got to that point, because we were already in America. We were already all over the world on each continent. So who were we before then? How can we know where we're going unless we know where we come from? Who were we before our identity and culture and language and belief systems were taken? And then even after slavery, because we built Black Wall Street, Seneca Village, that is now Central Park. We had Greensboro, South Carolina, Rosewood. There were several thriving places that we made without even reparations. We did it ourselves, that were bombed and burned on American soil. So when do we get deeper than slavery? Our history in America was before slavery, and we kept going after slavery. So who are we? When can we form and find our identity so that we can have a basis? Because we don't know who we are. We can barely identify with each other.
Javon Collins?
I agree. I mean, genealogy is very important. And I think for you, the fact that you're taking the time to research, the information, again, is out there. There's lots of information. You think of the Africans who were basically crew people on Spanish ships. So that does tell you a little something about the Africans who are living on the coast. Were they traveling across the waters even before Christopher Columbus? You think of before Columbus with Ivan von Sertermann. You have a lot of documentation of who we were before slavery. But it's up to each individual to want that knowledge, to know who they are. And I think if we collectively have that desire to know who we are and come together, I think we can definitely make an impact of putting that information, especially for the younger generation, to know who they are and to be proud of who they are, proud of their ancestry. And I think to the question earlier, a lot of people didn't have pride. We were so, you know, hurt, you know, therefore there was no ability to love ourselves.
Traumatized.
Yeah. So that is just, again, the PTSD that 400 years from the DNA of our ancestors is still within us.
Shantae, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. And Rahani in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Rahani.
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Fine. Thank you.
Okay, I want to get right to the question. I want to ask the professor from Ohio State to elaborate on the history of the name of Africa, where it came from, because we're Africans in America. So where did the name come from as African, and how did you get to the continent of Africa?
Let me expand this a little bit. Because this speaks to two questions that we've had. The question from the last call, Ashante, which was a serious question about identity, and the very first question from Tony, who I believe it was, who you know, Alshon Jeffrey is a wide receiver in the NFL, so he wasn't being serious. But there's a point to it, the idea of naming. And to connect the last two questions, so what Ashante was saying is, sort of the black experience, black identity, begins before enslavement. Absolutely, that's the power of this of having African in the identity, because it connects to a culture, to a people, and most importantly, to a place. Part of the ethnic identity, whether you are Igbo or whatever, is lost, is stripped away during the process of enslavement over the course of generations. Although the cultural practices remain. And so the name Africa itself, I mean, you know, there's various interpretations, Akibulana, whatever it is. The current accepting of it, Africanus, is this, and perhaps in the future that will change. But right now that stands in and that represents the continent, the place from which we came, the land that is still there, that represents the culture, that represents the community, that represents the people that were stripped away, but the core elements remained. And so no matter what we call it, and eventually it will change in term, right now what's recognized is African, but I think what's most important is connecting that and saying that this is the beginning, this is the root, because that is where you're able to see that original humanity that isn't stripped away, attempted to, but isn't, while as we go through this history of enslavement.
Rahani, thank you so much for that call. I got time for just one more, and I just got rid of the wrong call. Rob in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Ann. Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
Hey, I wanted to ask, this question is for Mr. Jeffries and Mr. Collins, and I really appreciate you guys speaking out. This country has come a long way, and as African Americans, we've come a long way. And I noticed on the census, and I just wanted to reiterate the previous caller's statement that on the census, we have so many names that they call us, and we know the most deplorable word is the N word, and then they call us African Americans, mm-hmm. Negro, all these other names. But when it comes to
that was weird. Yeah, we're cut off and we are running out of time. I'm not sure where he's going with that, though.
But I think it speaks to if what we already addressed, this question of identity and naming. And I think in the end, the most appropriate naming is how we name ourselves and what we choose to name ourselves, which reflects not only the past, but also the current political conditions in which people find themselves.
The event, the third annual African American Cultural Festival. You have 1 minute.
Yes,
dance. There's theater.
Education. We're working with some people with the James Preston Poindexter Foundation, but it's led by the City of Columbus. I've worked with that committee for the past 2 years, and they asked, "Hey, what can we do this year?" And I said, "The quadricentennial." I think it's a great opportunity to reflect, educate, and prepare for the future. You know, so to equip everyone with the right information, mm-hmm. and just keeping that debate and continuing this as a topic, so we can continue to discuss and continue to inform so many. So we invite everyone to come out. And we're just so thankful to be here today.
Javon Collins, thanks so much for joining us to talk about it. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Javon Collins is the Performing Arts Director for the King Arts Complex. And Hassan Kwame Jeffries, as always, thank you so much for your time. I always appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries is a professor of African American history at Ohio State University. I also want to remind you that you can go to a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides to learn more about the third annual African American Cultural Festival, which talks about the quadricentennial of the beginning of the enslavement of humans in the United States, or back then it was the colonies. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to the AllSight staff, producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson and Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Have a great day. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.